Chronicle Number 1. The Shunned Cellar. A chronicle from the paranormal investigations of Nathaniel Crowe within the Emergent Cycle. Penned by Emery Holt, archivist, the Dunwich Examiner. For my wife, who believed, and my family, who endured. From the archivist. The document you now hold in your hands, perhaps examined beneath the wavering glow of flickering candlelight, has been meticulously compiled from a variety of materials retrieved under circumstances that can only be described as dubious at best and at no small cost, both financial and personal. This tome represents the most recent installment in the ever-expanding corpus of fieldwork conducted by Mr. Nathaniel Crowe, a man whose name remains seldom mentioned in the annals of official record. Yet it is said that his hand has scrawled across more marginalia, case files, and sealed folios in this very archive than that of any other investigator whose work we possess. Each notation reflects his relentless pursuit of the hidden and the unknown, as though he were carving out his own legacy amid the shadows of obscurity that so often envelop his endeavors. I have taken meticulous care to present these chronicles in their most complete and unadulterated form, though I must offer a solemn warning to any reader who dares delve into these pages. Fragments have been lost to the relentless passage of time, ink has been smeared by the careless hand of fate, and entire passages remain obscured, mercilessly redacted by parties unknown, their purpose shrouded in secrecy and intent. What persists, however, has been faithfully preserved, often verbatim, from Mr. Crowe's own journals and the supporting ephemera that accompany them. The structure you find herein is the result of my editorial hand. The madness that seeps through every word and curlicue, however, is undeniably his. Such is the nature of the truths we pursue, fragmented, elusive, and burdened with an unsettling weight that speaks to the unfathomable depths of human experience and cosmic horror alike. Whether you come as a casual observer, intrigued by whispers of the esoteric, or as a fervent seeker of unnameable truths hidden within the folds of reality, I implore you to proceed with caution and a keen awareness of the context surrounding the narratives that follow. The events recounted within these pages did not transpire in isolation, devoid of connection or consequence. Rather, they unfold as part of a larger tapestry, woven together by threads of fate that stretch backward into the murky depths of history and forward into the uncertain expanse of the future. These patterns, these disquieting echoes of the past, resonate with a chilling familiarity, hinting at forces yet to fully reveal themselves. I fear indeed that they are not finished with us, and that the specters of what has been will continue to haunt our waking lives, entwining us in their unrelenting grasp. In Trust and Dread, Emery Holt, archivist, the Dunwich Examiner, Barrow Street Annex, Dunwich, Massachusetts. Prologue. Dunwich Examiner Archives. The Dunwich Examiner began its print in the winter of 1889 as a modest but earnest periodical devoted to the familiar rhythms of New England life. In its earliest years, one might have found within its pages the usual preoccupations of a coastal township: reports of maritime traffic, weathered minutes from town meetings, notices of births and passings, and the latest gossip trailing from the parlors of Essex County's long-seated families. It was, by design, a publication of order, a journal of the known and the nameable. But time, as ever, permits drift, and drift it did. By the close of the last century, the Examiner had become the reluctant custodian of submissions that defied ordinary filing, anecdotes unmoored from verifiable source, unattributed testimonies, faint copies of typewritten police records marked by excisions that were neither official nor explained. These matters were not formally published. They were filed, slid into a circulation drawer with no masthead and no oversight. It came to be known, by those who dared speak of it, as the Special Investigator's File. That is where I was placed. Not out of malice, I think, nor quite oversight. I was efficient and disinclined toward complaint. The file was regarded as an archive of misfits, a bin of curios and errant oddities. But the longer I lingered in its company, the more certain I became that something in its depths resisted dismissal. There were patterns that should not have persisted, names that repeated where they ought not be known, townships misaligned with modern cartography. And then, in time, a name began to rise from the scattered pages like breath on cold glass. Crow. At first it meant little, a surname appearing in the footnote of an unsigned affidavit or etched on the reverse of a sepia photograph, too blurred to identify. I thought little of it until it returned. Again and again. Not in the spotlight, but always near. Present as a trace. A watermark. I made inquiries. Quietly. Discreetly. Then, one evening, a parcel arrived. It was left at the threshold of the annex office, wrapped in oilskin, sealed with wax, unlabeled. No letter, no explanation. Within it lay a journal, leather-bound, fire-warped, its pages stitched and numbered by hand. The script inside was dense, deliberate, and possessed of an unsettling clarity. What it described corresponded to half a dozen incidents buried in the very drawer I had come to oversee. That first journal unlocked the file. What had once been a chaos of fragments began to speak in chorus. Misfiled clippings aligned with detailed notations. Witness accounts matched symbols that had once seemed ornamental. In time, more items arrived. Scorched maps, wax cylinders packed in salt, ink-penned sketches of impossible geometry. The margins of reality, it seemed, had been under surveillance. And I, against both better judgment and personal inclination, had become their custodian. I do not exaggerate when I say the archive changed me. I have known flickering lights in rooms with no wiring. I have read pages that rewrite themselves if left unopened too long. There are entries I transcribed under duress of sound alone, groaning loops of half-erased tape that never played the same way twice. Still, I persisted. For the shape in the dark had begun to resolve, and its name, always, was Nathaniel Crowe. Who is Nathaniel Crowe? Insofar as records allow, Nathaniel Crowe was a scholar. His name appears briefly in the rolls of Miskatonic University, with mention of studies in antiquities, folklore, and comparative theology. Professors recalled him as sharp-minded, unflinchingly rational, and destined for an academic future. And then came Dunwich. Whatever befell him there, whatever he witnessed in that valley of shuttered homes and unspeaking fields, it unmoored him. He withdrew from university life shortly thereafter, not in disgrace, but with a quiet urgency, as though academia could no longer contain what he now knew. He placed discreet advertisements, offered services for matters of unusual concern. Thus began his descent, or his ascension. That much remains unclear. What is known is that Crowe investigated what others would not touch. Farmhouses that bled, cellars that sighed, lighthouses whose glass refused to reflect. He chronicled these incursions with clinical discipline. Journals, photographs, audio impressions. Scrawlings that blurred the line between language and lamentation. And in 1931, he vanished. No grave. No witness, no conclusive trace, only his writings which continued to arrive. And in the years that followed, the whispers. Figures glimpsed beyond fogged glass, a voice repeating warnings before radio's lost signal, a silhouette departing just as the light returned. His work did not end, nor perhaps did he. The work that remains. It has fallen to me to arrange the remnants, to gather what can be known and to shield what should not. I do not pretend to offer a complete picture. These chronicles are partial by nature, scarred, interrupted, and unfinished. But they are real. And more importantly, they are a warning. Crow did not write to persuade. He wrote to endure. Each chronicle that follows is drawn from his recovered journals, supplemented where possible with corroborating material from the examiner's restricted archives. I have endeavored to alter nothing. Where fragments have been lost, I have left silence. Where contradictions arise, I have preserved them. For truth, when brushed by such forces, does not always obey the shape of narrative. So long as new journals continue to arrive, this work shall continue. There will be no final volume, no conclusive ledger, only a spiral narrowing toward a center I dare not name. To those who now turn this page, proceed with caution. Understanding is a blade without hilt. Once taken up, it cuts both ways. Chapter 1. The Cellar Unsealed. The sky over Arkham sagged low, an ashen pall of cloud pressing upon gabled roofs and chimney stacks like a smothering hand. The air was not merely cool, but damp with a dread that seemed to leach upward from the earth. Along Whitcroft Street, a narrow, shadow-choked lane overlooked by moss-darkened eaves and long-abandoned widows' walks, stood the Mallory Estate, a structure that wore its centuries not as adornment but as a wound poorly dressed. Arthur Pendle hesitated before its warped iron gate, his fingers trembling not from cold but from something deeper. His breath steamed in the autumn air, though he could feel the heat behind him, unnatural and sour, like the breath of an opened crypt. The house loomed with an indifference that bordered on hostility, its shutters all closed, its windows opaque with dust and time. Not even the crows that dogged Arkham's spires landed upon its roof. He adjusted his cravat with a hand that barely obeyed, drawing a shaking breath before crossing the threshold. The moment he stepped onto the walk, the fog behind him thickened, like a curtain drawn closed. Inside, the house reeked of fungal rot and rust, though no rain had fallen in a fortnight. The walls were panelled in dark walnut, faded to a dry reddish hue, like old blood. Floorboards groaned beneath his feet with a sound that might have been wood, or a voice just below the threshold of hearing. He had the distinct sense that he was not alone. Three workmen had been hired for appraisal and basic restoration. Whatever had befallen them was already being spoken of in fragments and second-hand accounts. One man, Harlan, was said to have returned from the cellar altered, his manner fractured by fear and paranoia, his fingernails dark with blood, where he had gouged his own forearms in fits of unprovoked terror. Those who encountered him afterward reported that he spoke in a lilting, almost ceremonial cadence that would abruptly collapse into frantic rambling, the words arranged in patterns that made sense only to him. Another, Collins, had vanished two nights prior, last seen descending toward the basement with a crowbar and a coil of rope. Of the third man, little could be recorded beyond his refusal to return to the house at all. Pendle descended the creaking central stair, past family portraits whose features had long since faded into anonymous smudges. At the base, a short hallway veered left, ending in a warped door slick with a dark varnish that had never dried. It was here, behind generations of cobweb and boarded plaster, that a bricked-over sub-cellar had been uncovered, an architectural impossibility not recorded in any ledger, plan, or deed. He approached the sealed entrance, the air growing warmer with each step. Moisture beaded on his temples despite the chill outside. The heat was not radiant but ambient, oppressive, alive. The cellar door was of thick oak, blistered and blackened near the hinges. A circular iron ring served as its handle, rusted but strangely warm to the touch. Pendle hesitated, swallowed hard, and pulled. Nothing moved. Then, from the other side came three sharp knocks. Deliberate, rhythmic. Pendle staggered back, his vision swimming. A sudden vertigo overtook him, and for a moment he saw the walls bend inward, impossibly, like the inside of a mouth exhaling. In the stone, for the briefest flicker, he glimpsed an outline, vast, coiled and pulsing beneath the floor. He fled, his footsteps echoing off the warped walls like the patter of a pursued man. Later, in the frayed quiet of his lamp-lit study, Pendle penned the letter that would begin the unsealing not of a cellar, but of something buried far deeper. To Mr. Nathaniel Crowe, West Pickman Street, Arkham, urgent and confidential. Nathaniel read the letter twice. Its ink was rushed but not illegible, each stroke trembling at the edge of control. Pendle had not hidden his fear, nor attempted to dress it in legalese. He described the heat, the missing man, the senseless ramblings of the injured one, and the sense that the house itself watched. Crow's fingers hovered for a moment over the final lines. "There is something beneath, Mr. Crow. I do not know what it is, but I cannot return alone. I believe something old is waking, and it does not wish to be seen." Crow folded the page and slid it into his journal, where a dozen other cases lay bound in cipher. He stood and moved to the window of his West Pickman Street office. The sky over Arkham had turned a sickly amber. The sunset filtered through coils of fog that rose not from the river, but from the city's very foundations. He turned toward his shelves, rows of cracked tomes, inked scrolls, and glass vials labeled in forgotten tongues. A low vibration seemed to hum beneath the floorboards as he withdrew a sealed envelope marked Mallory 1871, deferred inquiry. The name struck him as half-remembered, like a dream blurred by waking. He knew it, had heard it once before, whispered in connection with something old, something not spoken of at Miskatonic. And yet he could find no record of the family beyond lease documents and a sealed deed filed decades prior. No obituaries, no census returns. Nothing but a name and an address that had not appeared on modern maps until the bricked cellar was broken open. He packed his satchel with care, including his recorder, his warded compass, and the small brass cruciform lens given to him by a dying man who had once read geometry that bled. Before departing, he lit a single candle on the windowsill, a warding rite older than even the city. The flame guttered briefly in a draft that came from nowhere. Whitcroft Street was quiet. Too quiet. As Crow approached on foot, the light grew redder, though no sun remained. A mist curled at ankle height, too thick and too warm for autumn. His breath failed to fog. The locals he passed offered no greeting. They turned instead, crossing the street without eye contact, their faces pale and expressionless. The Mallory estate loomed at the corner where the street bent into a cul-de-sac, shrouded by trees whose leaves had not fallen but shriveled in place, blackening like blighted fruit. Pendle waited outside, his coat drawn tight, hands jammed into his pockets as if to hold himself together. "You came," he said. His voice was small, almost grateful. Crow nodded. "I seldom ignore an invitation from the dead." Pendle swallowed. "They didn't find Collins? Not even a shoe?" Together they crossed the threshold. The interior was unchanged and yet different. The temperature seemed to pulse as though the house exhaled only when unobserved. The wallpaper peeled not from age but from something beneath it pressing outward. Crow ran a gloved finger along the balustrade. Dust clung to it, dark and dry, smelling of crushed rose petals and burned hair. They reached the cellar door in silence. It no longer resisted. As Crow placed a hand on the rusted ring, the wood beneath his palm pulsed once like a heartbeat. He said nothing. He opened the door. The air within was rancid with age and damp heat, but not still. It churned faintly, like breath drawn through 100 unseen throats. Stone steps descended into darkness that did not invite intrusion. Only the edges of the torchlight penetrated, revealing walls of fitted stone, too regular for colonial masonry, too warped to be Euclidean. Crow lit a second lantern and passed it to Pendle, who accepted it with a twitch of hesitation. "Stay behind me. Do Do not speak unless necessary, and if you feel cold, say so immediately. Pendle nodded. They descended. Halfway down, Crow paused. The walls were wet. Not with water. A film, almost gelatinous, shimmered over the stone. Glyphs, faint as bruises, floated just beneath the surface, shifting subtly, as if trying not to be seen. And then he heard it, a whisper in the marrow of his bones. A word he could not translate, but knew. It curved inward, folding thought into sensation. The voice said his name, not aloud, but remembered. Nathaniel.